I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Police chiefs, prosecutors, and sheriffs from across the country who call themselves law enforcement leaders to reduce crime and incarceration announced recently that there are too many people in prison in this country. They say it's possible to reduce the incarceration rate and the crime rate, and they've called for reforms of the criminal justice system. Meanwhile, it looks like there's bipartisan support in Congress for the Safe Justice Act, the Smarter Sentencing Act. And later this week, the Justice Department is poised to release thousands of inmates held in federal prison for drug offenses. What is happening? Why this change from the tough-on-crime policies of several decades ago? We asked Sari Horowitz to join us. She's a reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers the U.S. Department of Justice. And she worked on a year-long series of on sentencing reform called Unwinding the Drug War. And Sari Horowitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. So why this really seismic shift when it comes to criminal justice?
I think what we're seeing is a national shift in the country's approach to criminal justice and crime and punishment. And as you pointed out, there was a group of 130 law enforcement officials, police chiefs, and sheriffs that came together and called for an end to mass incarceration. And today, President Obama is addressing the International Association of Chiefs of Police in Chicago on this very issue. And we're seeing legislation, which I can explain to you more about in a few minutes. What's really important to know about the thousands of inmates being released that you mentioned is that these inmates are not going to all walk out of prison on November 1st, or between October 30th and November 1st. The floodgates are not going to open, because I know there's a lot of concern from the public on this. All of these inmates first had to go before a judge to get approval for their petition to make sure that there wasn't violence in their past and a concern about public safety. And then all these inmates had gone to halfway houses first, and they're going to be released from halfway houses. And then they're going to go, some have already been in home confinement, and then they'll be put on supervised release with the probation officer. So I think that's really important to understand. And about a third of the 6,000 inmates being released, so 2,000 of them, are foreign citizens who will be deported. I think that about 97 of them will be returned to Pennsylvania.
Well, let me pick up on just a couple of things. And even going back to my original question, is it responding to the financial costs of keeping so many people in prison? Is it also about the social costs of having such a high rate of incarceration?
It's actually both, Marty. There's a huge financial cost. I mean, taxpayers spend about $80 billion across this country each year on prisons and jails. That's counting state, local, federal. Nearly a third of the Justice Department's approximately $27 billion budget is spent on federal prisons and could be spent on other public safety costs. So that's part of it. The other part is that there's a sense, and you're seeing this on Capitol Hill, you're seeing it in the White House and the Justice Department, that these very harsh sentences, drug sentences from the 1980s and 90s during the war on drugs, were unfair. And so this is an attempt to reverse the drug war and reduce these sentences.
What's so interesting when you think about police chiefs and prosecutors and sheriffs, I mean, these are really the law enforcement that we have in this country, that they are calling for things like an end to mandatory minimums, even reducing the number of criminal laws. And I'm assuming that when you've got law enforcement people saying this stuff, that people are listening.
You're exactly right. This group that was formed, Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration, and this was a group formed, spearheaded by the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. This group really represents a big public shift in philosophy for dozens of law enforcement officers, because realize law enforcement officials have sort of, their careers are based on tough on crime strategies, really. And now these leaders are saying that reducing incarceration is going to really improve public safety, because especially with drug offenders who need treatment for drug or alcohol problems and mental health issues, they're going to be more likely to reintegrate into society and improve if they get care, which jails and prisons often do not offer.
Talk a bit about what's happening in Congress, because I think that's also an interesting development. We actually did a show a couple of months ago about how the ACLU and the Koch brothers are on the same page on, I think it's mandatory minimums. What's going on in Congress?
It's fascinating what's going on in Congress. And I wrote a whole story about the Koch brothers joining forces with President Obama. And that's what we're seeing. The Koch brothers, conservative senators like Charles Grassley and the ACLU, behind legislation on the Hill. There are several bills that have been introduced on Capitol Hill, something like four, six, seven, eight of them. But the ones that are really making headway, that are going forward at this point, the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. That was introduced in the Senate, introduced in the House, the Senate by Grassley and Goodlatte in the House. And that would adjust mandatory minimum sentences with a focus on reducing penalties for nonviolent drug crimes. Some people feel like it doesn't go far enough, but it's also really considered the most significant legislation that we've seen in decades.
And this issue of mandatory minimums, that seems to be a theme that sort of runs through all these groups as they look at how to reduce the incarceration rate, but also ensure public safety.
Right. I mean, the mandatory minimums of the 80s and 90s required sentences of like 25, 20, 15 years, and judges really didn't have discretion. I interviewed someone named Ronald White, who was a special counsel to the U.S. Sentencing Commission during the late 1980s. And he said that mandatory minimum sentences and their enhancements, which made them longer, were all about math. And not about people. You looked at guidelines and you added up numbers. And he said that these laws forced judges to look at their calculators instead of into the eyes of the defendants they were sentencing. And judges really weren't allowed to ask, how did these defendants get to this point in their lives and who are they going to be in 5 or 20 years? And so, I mean, I wrote about a woman, Sharonda Jones, in Texas. First time, first arrest, nonviolent, low-level drug offender, who is serving a sentence right now of life without parole.
Wow. Life without parole. In fact, I'm looking at that article that you wrote, and her daughter, it sounds like, had lobbied for her release, but was unsuccessful.
Yes, she's one of many thousands of people who have applied for clemency from President Obama. And this is, of course, different than the legislation and different than all the other initiatives going on right now, where the president has the right to reduce sentences and commute sentences and give clemency. And he's done that in 89 cases. Sharonda Jones has not received clemency yet. Her daughter is fighting for her. Her daughter was 8 years old when her mother went to prison, again, for her first arrest, nonviolent, low-level drug offender. And her daughter is now 24 years old, and her entire childhood, she's missed her mother being with her.
But what's so interesting about President Obama is that he seems to be very careful about clemency but willing to at least look at some of our laws and try to reduce the incarceration rate going in that direction.
Right. I mean, the White House is somewhat involved in the legislation going forward on the Hill. It's still very much a work in progress. The one thing the president can do is clemency. I think there are many sentencing advocates out there who feel like the White House is not moving fast enough on that front. This was an initiative announced with a great deal of fanfare, but it's moving pretty slowly. I mean, 89 people have received clemency, more than any other presidents have given, but still there are high expectations that more low-level, nonviolent drug offenders could be released. And the 6,000 inmates that are coming out between October 30th and November 1st realize that is not coming from the Obama administration. That is all because of an act by the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which is an independent agency that sets the sentencing policies for federal crimes. And last year, the Sentencing Commission, in an effort to reduce crowding in federal prisons, but also to give relief to drug offenders, like we've been talking about, who were sentenced under these harsh policies during the crack cocaine epidemic, this Sentencing Commission reduce the punishment for future drug offenders, and then, in a very important action, made that retroactive. And that's why these thousands of inmates are about to come out.
And it's interesting to make sure that people understand we're talking about the federal prisons, and of course there are state prisons, and then there are jails as well. What we've been talking about, does that apply largely to the federal prisons?
The inmates who are being released and the legislation that we've talked about, that's all federal prisons. Federal prisons have 200,000 inmates. About half of them are drug offenders. But if you look at the total population in the United States, it's like 2.3 million.
Is there any pushback coming from any quarters to some of these changes or potential changes in our criminal justice system?
There is some pushback, Marty. Eric Holder last year changed the charging policies, so going forward, and told his federal prosecutors not to charge low-level, nonviolent drug offenders who have no connections to gangs or large-scale drug organizations with offenses that carry these severe mandatory sentences. But some prosecutors out in the field and some FBI agents and police feel that these mandatory minimum sentences in some cases are very important in terms of a deterrent and also in terms of punishment and in terms of getting information from low-level offenders, holding that threat that they might have to serve 20, 25, 50 years to life, that will help them convince these low-level offenders to give up higher-level people on the ring.
I guess it should be said that this new group represents 130 prosecutors and district attorneys, I guess, and not, of course, all of them in this country.
Not all of them, but some very big names. You've got Charles Ramsey, the police commissioner in Philadelphia. You have the president of the National Conference of Black Law Enforcement Executives. You have the New York City Police Chief Bill Bratton, Gary McCarthy, police chief of Chicago. You have the police chief of D.C., the former ATF director, Todd Jones. So you have some of the most prominent law enforcement officials in the country who have added their support and really their clout to this growing movement, as you pointed out, to reduce the nation's incarceration rate.
The president is in Chicago today talking to the Association of Police Chiefs, so I guess adding his voice to this current conversation.
Absolutely, and he met with some of these law enforcement leaders, some of the 130 in that new group. He met at the White House last week with them, and he had a forum. At the same time, the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, has been talking quite a lot about recidivism, and the Department of Justice has announced plans to give a $53 million grant to local programs that provide support to former inmates, because recidivism is a huge problem. There aren't great statistics on this, but there's about a 67% recidivism rate if you look at state prisons. It's lower for nonviolent drug offenders, but recidivism is a huge issue.
Well, we're going to be talking about that with some of our guests so later on in the hour. Sari Horowitz, thanks for getting our conversation started. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she's a reporter for The Washington Post, covers the Justice Department, and worked on a year-long series on sentencing reform titled Unwinding the Drug War. And we have two guests waiting in the wings as we carry on our conversation talking about a shift, a changing attitude towards criminal justice and our high rate of incarceration. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And in this hour, we are talking about reforming our criminal justice system. In fact, calls of reform from law enforcement, from Congress, from the White House, strange bedfellows like the Koch brothers and the ACLU. The idea that there's just too high rate of incarceration in this country, and it's possible to reduce that rate and also ensure public safety. Joining us now is Nicole Fortier, counsel in the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. She's senior coordinator for the Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration, a group we were talking about in the first portion of Radio Times. And Nicole Fortier, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Neil Franklin, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And that's a group of current and former law enforcement officials who work to legalize drugs. He's previously served in the Maryland State Police as a narcotics agent and in the Baltimore Police Department. And Neil Franklin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Marty, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on board.
You're very welcome. Nicole, let me begin with you, and I guess begin with a question I put to our guest, Sari Horowitz. Are we witnessing a kind of a turning point when it comes to incarceration and criminal justice?
We absolutely are. This is a huge moment across the country for criminal justice reform. Politicians, the public, the media, and now, of course, law enforcement are all coming together to say that what is currently happening isn't good and that we can fix it.
And is it that we're spending $80 billion a year and wondering what are we getting for that money?
To some extent, that's what it is. But to some extent, it's also a public safety concern. We know that we can keep crime down at these levels without such consequences, without the fiscal consequences, without the social consequences, and without our political consequences.
The idea that you can keep crime down and also release people from prison without worrying about an uptick in the crime rate?
Absolutely. This group is really coming together because it believes, after devoting their lives to public safety, that you really can hone in on violent crime and dangerous crime without necessarily arresting everyone for low-level crimes. And when you don't pull those people into the system, you may actually ensure more public safety by not bringing them into a system that tends to turn out repeat offenders.
Neil Franklin, let me get you in on the conversation as head of law enforcement against prohibition. What do you make of what this group is doing?
Well, I agree. It's also about time, not just for this group, but for our country to move in a different direction. I find it interesting that your previous guest, Sari, I think you said the title of what she was working on was kind of unwinding the war on drugs.
Yes.
And when you look back, you go back 40 years or 50 years, that's when our surge in incarceration in this country began, this uphill climb. Dramatically, and into the 80s, it even became worse as we got tougher on crime and being drug-related crimes. And I think that the carnage is now being witnessed. The data is coming in quite clear. And I think our law enforcement leaders, mainly the 130 that we are speaking about and more, are realizing that prisons are no place to, I guess I'll use the word, rehabilitate nonviolent offenders. Because prisons are violent places. In some cases, you have to be violent in order to survive. They're not correctional facilities. They do not properly prepare people for reentry into society. And by far and large, most of those folks are coming back to us in our neighborhoods and in our communities. And we've got to have the support mechanisms in place. You mentioned recidivism. When we send them home, we've got to send them home to support. We've got to prepare them before they come out of those institutions, and then we have to prop them up when they return home with great wraparound services, which is still going to be a lot less costly than housing them 24/7 in an institution in this country.
And I do want to pick up on recidivism, which, of course, is so important. But, Neil Franklin, let me ask you, our crime rate, broadly speaking, is at something like a 50-year low. One of the arguments for explaining that is that the people that would commit those crimes are in prison. What do you say in response to that?
There's absolutely no definitive study that relates to that. No one can actually put their finger on it. But one thing there are a number of things I think that come into play here. And number one is there's been a great reclassifying of crimes throughout the years. I know that the city that I'm from, Baltimore, unfortunately went through a period where they were reclassifying crimes, which had a lot to do with the reported crime rate. Now, of course, murders, it's hard to declassify and change. But I think for my 30-plus years in law enforcement, it tends to be cyclical. And over the past four decades, it has been cyclical, up and down, up and down. But if we want a significant decrease in crime, violent crime, we're going to have to start bringing people home and stop sending. It's not just about recidivism. It's about ending the pathway into prison. It's about ending the numbers of arrests that we currently make. And looking at what some of our other countries do in Europe, you know, they manage things a whole lot different and better than what we do, apparently, where their rate of incarceration is, for most of those countries, is somewhere around 100 citizens per 100,000. Well, and we're up somewhere around 700.
Let me pick up on something, Nicole, that Neil just said about criminalizing more behaviors. When you look back between now, back a couple of decades, is that what you see as well? Is that there are just more behaviors that now can get you in trouble with the law?
Absolutely. I think in the fear of the 80s and the early 90s of impending crime and crime going up, there was a lot of fear from the public, from politicians, and a lot of what they did was to really toughen down. And part of toughening down on behavior was to make things illegal that weren't necessarily illegal before. Public drunkenness, now illegal. You can ride your bike on the sidewalk, and it's now illegal. And there's the option to bring somebody into jail, into prison, because of that. The idea is to sort of crack down on those smaller offenses and you stop a problem. But what we're beginning to see is you don't have to do that. In the last 5 years or so, states and even the federal government have begun to roll back on these behaviors, on the lengths of sentences, and we're still seeing crime at an incredibly historic low, which shows us that crime is really a complicated problem, and incarceration as a knee-jerk reaction is too simple of a solution. It's not the reason crime has gone down. We can't tell you why, because it's too many factors. But incarceration alone is clearly not the answer.
Is that the broken window theory? The idea is that you want to kind of nip crime in the bud, so you arrest someone for drunkenness, thereby preventing another crime to be committed?
Yes. That's one part of the broken windows theory. I think that really this theory goes beyond those who necessarily preach broken windows. It's a theory that they want to find low-level crimes and really crack down in order to show that they won't tolerate crime. That's not necessarily broken windows in every circumstance, but broken windows is an example.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Nicole Fortier, and she's counsel in the Justice Program, and that's at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, a senior coordinator for the Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. And just last week, this group announced that they want to do things to reduce the incarceration rate in this country. Also with us is Neil Franklin, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and again, a group of current and former law enforcement who are working to legalize drugs. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Neil, is your group calling for legalizing of all drugs? Do you see that as a way to both reduce the crime weight and also reduce the incarceration rate?
Absolutely, Marty. But it's not just some free-for-all. It's about regulation and control. We all know that if you want to reduce the abuse of drug use anywhere, it's got to be about regulation. I mean, right now we have pretty much, through our policies of prohibition, given all management of these drugs, heroin, cocaine, meth, we've literally turned it over to criminal organizations and gangs. And in doing so, you actually have more access points for people who want to buy it, including people who are not 21 years of age, our young people. Our young people also heavily recruited by these gangs and crews and the cartels, recruited into their businesses to sell these drugs. Where do they sell them? They sell them in our schools, to their peers. This is absolutely the worst system we could have ever put in place for managing drugs. The drugs are here. There's no such thing as a drug-free society. It never will be. The question is, what is the best possible management method for these drugs that are among us in our communities? And we believe that a system of regulation and control will absolutely do two major things. Number one, reduce the violent crime. It's currently the platform for most of the violent crime that we have in our country by far, and greatly reduce our issue of mass incarceration in this country.
Well, Nicole, let me get you to pick up on that as a senior coordinator for this group of law enforcement officials. Is that group willing to go as far as Neil's group?
Our group is willing to go wherever we feel our voice is needed more than anything else. We're really bringing together this really powerful group of individuals, Neil included, actually, and we're trying to find the common ground on law enforcement in this issue. And the common ground that we have found is that we really need to lend our voice to politicians, to policymakers, and to the public throughout the country and say that overall, we know from experience that crime and incarceration can go down at the same time. And beyond that, we hope to endorse and work towards our efforts on increasing alternatives to arrest and prosecution, decreasing the number of criminal laws for low-level offenses, reforming mandatory minimum laws, and strengthening law enforcement community ties. We're really hoping through those four areas in particular that this group of law enforcement can really get one, other law enforcement, and two, lawmakers to understand that we don't have to be tough on crime anymore. We can be smart about it, and we can bring both crime and incarceration down.
And are you speaking also about the social consequences of having such a high rate of charging people for crimes, in that someone gets arrested, they go to jail, they may get out, they may spend some time in prison, then it's hard to get a job, they don't see their children. Is that part of the cycle that you're trying to stop?
Absolutely. This group has really seen firsthand how communities are disrupted by the laws and the policies that we have been promoting for the last few decades. They see firsthand the problems that happen to young men and young women across the country once they're brought into the system, especially those who are brought in for nonviolent and low-level crimes, who then later can't get jobs, can't get housing, can't get education loans. The list goes on and on. The collateral consequences are too big, and that's why this group feels so strongly about this. They know that you can bring down crime, and you don't need all of these consequences to go along with it. And that's why they're coming together, and why they launched last week, and why they're very excited to jump on the road and really tackle any issue that comes against them in the states and on the federal level.
And again, that's Nicole Fortier, and she works with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, and coordinator of this group that made an announcement last week. This is the group, the Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. Also with us, Neil Franklin, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And we are talking about efforts both in Congress, but also across the country among prosecutors and district attorneys to try to address the high rate of incarceration in the United States. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Neil, let me ask you just a bit about recidivism, and that is a problem, I think a problem for a whole host of reasons. What can be done to reduce the level of recidivism?
Well, there are, and let me use the example of Baltimore. It's just a small microcosm of major cities in the United States. There are so many wonderful programs. Many of them are managed by formerly incarcerated people in Baltimore, you know, who are now out of prison, and they've set up organizations to assist others who are returning home. But they do not have the resources, either financially or otherwise, to deal with the numbers of people who need their services. And there's no one better to guide someone once they return home than someone who's already traveled that path. So we have to look again at the resources that we make available for such efforts and make sure that those organizations that have proven themselves and have the data to demonstrate that they get the funding that's needed so that they can increase the services that they provide. But one of the problems is a lot of people who are returning home, if you're a returning felon, you know, there are policies that prohibit you from interacting with a someone who is also a convicted felon. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me at a time when they need, you know, the assistance that they do. And I just want to, related to that, I want to comment on something that you mentioned, that you were talking about earlier, and Nicole mentioned. And it's about our young people, and some people refer to it as school-to-prison pipeline. Think about this. We have literally punted mischief behavior of our young people to the police to deal with. Years ago, throwing a carrot at a teacher, a teenager throwing a carrot at a teacher, would have been handled through administrative processes at the school, sanctions, what have you. Now we call the police. A seven-year-old acting out in class, you know, however, now we call the police to handcuff them. And you see this over and over and over again. And we've literally just given up this control to the police. We call them for everything. And I think a lot of that has to do with the disintegration of the family unit because of our broken criminal justice system, because of the numbers of people that we've sent to prison over the past 4 to 5 decades. And we've greatly disrupted the family unit. And it's very, I guess, Robert Peel, who is who we consider the father of modern-day policing from England, came up with 9 basic policing principles. And number 7 says, you know, that the police are the community and the community are the police. We're just the ones who get paid to do this work 24/7 to deal with the violent people in our society. But at the end of the day, public safety is a community responsibility, and we've punted everything to the police to handle when most of it can be dealt with at a community, neighborhood, and family level. And we have to get back to that.
And Nicole, about a minute before our break here, does that address the community police tensions that we've seen in places like Baltimore and other cities as well?
Absolutely. We've really punted a lot of things. Neil is absolutely right. We've punted our entire system of education towards the police. We've punted mental illness to the police. We've punted drug addiction to the police. And now we're seeing that the police can only do so much, and the prison system is not the place to handle that. In fact, we're causing more problems than we're actually solving by doing that. And this group is really interested in trying to tackle those collateral consequences, in trying to tackle alternatives, to try to find ways that as a community, we can stop expecting police to do things that we need to handle ourselves or in other capacities.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Nicole Fortier and also Neil Franklin. And we have Mark Debo waiting in the wings, a deputy district attorney for Los Angeles County, with another perspective on what we have been talking about. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Let me just recap here. We've been talking about the tough-on-crime policies of the 80s and 90s, how they have led to a dramatic increase in America's incarceration rate, and have exacerbated tensions between the public and the police. A coalition of police chiefs and prosecutors and sheriffs are rethinking those policies. Also, there's some bipartisan support in Congress for rethinking the approach to nonviolent, often drug-related crimes. And I've been talking in this hour with Nicole Fortier from the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, Neil Franklin, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And joining us now is Mark Debo. He's a Deputy District Attorney for Los Angeles County, also President of the Deputy District Attorneys Association. And Mark Debo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of these national efforts to try to reduce the country's incarceration rates?
I think they're reckless sometimes, misguided social engineering without the basis of experience of being in the courts or in the streets and dealing with these problems.
Explain what you mean.
Well, in California, we had what was called Prop 47. Prop 47 was a global reduction of a number of felonies to misdemeanors, specifically drug and theft-related offenses. And the idea was, let's rehabilitate the drug offenders. And in fact, what they've done is eliminated all incentive for rehabilitation by turning these offenses into misdemeanors.
And I'm looking at Proposition 47, changing how people are sentenced to a misdemeanor, simple drug possession, now a misdemeanor, petty theft under $950, a misdemeanor, shoplifting under $950, a forgery under $950, write a bad check for under $950, recipient of stolen property under $950. Are you saying that has actually increased the rate of crime in California?
Well, that seems to be pretty obvious. It's no coincidence that upon passage of this, shortly thereafter, the crime rates began to rise. There's a definite relationship between drug possession offenses and theft, because one way you fund your ability to possess those drugs is to steal. So by reducing the penalties for drug possession, you've increased the probability that theft crimes will increase, and that's exactly what's happening.
Well, and I know some of the money saved was supposed to go into things like crime prevention and treatment. Are you saying that hasn't happened?
Well, what's the maybe the unintended consequences is when it was a felony and somebody had the potential of doing more time in custody by going to state prison, there was a greater incentive to accept a drug treatment program that might be extensive. It may last a year or maybe a year and a half. What's the incentive when the best you can get after a trial, the maximum, would be 364 days? And with good work done credit, it would mean you'd only serve half of that. So you force, if you want to do something where you provide an incentive to seek drug rehabilitation, you've taken it away by reducing the crime to a misdemeanor. There's no leverage to get anybody to participate. Mm.
Neil Franklin, let me get you in on the conversation, get you to respond to what Mark DeBow was talking about. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, forced treatment, we already know, has a very, very low success rate. And literally, you're just taking that person somewhat out of the system for a small period of time. When someone, good treatment has to be wanted and embraced by the person, but that person's going to do whatever they need to do and agree to do whatever they need to do to prevent themselves from going into prison for any extended period of time. Even when they're incarcerated, there's not one drug-free prison that I know of in the United States or anywhere else for that matter, because of how lucrative the business is and how easy it is to get employees to smuggle drugs into the prison as well as others. But he also, Mark also makes the case again for, you know, when he's talking about these low-level drug offenders who are robbing, stealing, doing whatever to get the money to get what they need. See, that's when you look at countries like Switzerland, where we treat this as a health issue, you know, and we invite those people into a place, and for pennies on a dollar, they are tended to, given a pharmaceutical-grade substance, heroin, as many times as they need it during that day. And every time they come into the facility to get what they need under medical supervision, number one, they have zero overdose deaths under these programs. Number two, these people are no longer out in the streets committing the crimes that Mark is referring to, because they don't have to in order to get treated for what they need. And when they do come in voluntarily to these facilities, you know, we call these safe consumption facilities, when they do come in, they get wraparound services. They get other health matters tended to. They're talked to about employment and other things that are vital and critical, not just to surviving, but to thriving as a citizen. We have to look at how we, the laws that we put in place, again, I think it's all about what we are giving our police officers to do, the policies that we are giving our police officers to enforce are problematic and creating most of these problems that we had.
Mark, do you want to, we could do, we have done whole hours on that very issue. Anything you want to say in response to what Neil just said?
It's a ironic thing that they declare that drug addiction is a health problem when it's the only disease in which somebody voluntarily infects themselves. And then as a result, goes out into society and spreads disorder. So the greater solution to it, I don't pretend to know. I'm not as familiar with perhaps Switzerland as this gentleman is. However, you've seen now social engineers in California say that they don't want to punish drug offenders. And really, as he just said, the only successful programs are the ones they seek out on their own when they're ready to change and they can't be forced to change. And yet we give them the opportunity to do that and they don't seek it out. So all we've done is taking drug offenders and place them back on the streets with no incentive whatsoever to get any help. And now we have the proposal that let's give it out for free in America, which has a different economy-based organization in Switzerland. I don't think that's the solution to the problem unless you radically change all of America, which I don't see happening.
No.
So all we've done in California is let them out and increase crime. That's all we've done.
Let me put a question to you, Nicole. We got some folks that want to join the conversation. We're going to have to say goodbye to Mark. But to you, Nicole, are there risks, though, of reducing a crime to a misdemeanor, as Mark DeBow has been talking about?
Mark does have a point. California, while overall crime is going down, certain crimes, including theft, are on the rise. But what we really have to think about is the fact that California did Prop 47, amongst other changes, because they were ordered to do so by a court. Their prison population was so vastly over capacity that they no longer met constitutional boundaries.
Yeah, you know, just one federal judge.
Hold on, Mark, hold on 1 second. Go ahead, Nicole.
And absolutely. And I think really what our group is trying to say is we can learn from California. What's happening there are a lot of people are going out onto the street without mechanisms in place to help them. We haven't prepared California in order to help deal with drug addiction, to deal with homelessness, to deal with a lot of the issues that the prisons were masking. And what we think needs to happen is that other states need to think before ordered to deal with their prison population. Prop 47 was a natural outspringing of having to deal with needing to lower a prison population that was growing too rapidly. Other states need to start thinking about those other mechanisms, those other alternatives now, before they are in the same position.
Mark, we're going to have to say goodbye to you. Any quick comment before you have to go? No, go ahead.
Well, I don't agree. I don't agree that the problem couldn't be solved in other ways without releasing the criminals. And I do agree that there's got to be something between prison and just freedom on the street. There's got to be some more effective intervention at a higher level to make sure they don't reoffend. However, the solution isn't to just allow them to go free, and the solution isn't to reduce these crimes so that they are really insignificant. And that's what we've done.
And I think everyone can agree there should be something in between to help someone keep them out of prison and certainly help the recidivism rate as well. Mark DeBow, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Deputy District Attorney for Los Angeles County. We do have some callers that want to get in on the conversation. We've got Bob from Marlton joining us. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. This country has a huge prison industry, which is profited very handsomely from minimum sentencing laws. What kind of reaction are we getting from the prison industry to these attempts to change the laws and reduce the number of people in prison?
Bob, I'm going to toss that to Nicole Fortier. Nicole, what is the response of the prison industry?
Hi, Bob. That's a great question. I think that the prison industry doesn't speak in one voice, unfortunately, but there are several, a good portion of it is happy. Their prisons are over capacity. They're at their wit's end, and their resources are being cut. Unfortunately, we are not in a position in this country to constantly pay prisons and to constantly help them. There are other prisons, of course, that are nervous about having to close down if they're closed down overall. But I think that for the most part, what you hear from both the law enforcement community and from the corrections community is that they don't know how to deal with the problem, but they want to deal with it. They want to help it, and they don't want to see all of these people constantly coming back in.
Let me quote something that President Obama said, talking about Black Lives Matter. And, Neil, I'll put this to you. He said, I think everyone understands that all lives matter. Everyone wants strong, effective law enforcement. Everybody wants their kids to be safe when they're walking to school. Nobody wants to see police officers who are doing their job fairly hurt. Everyone understands that this is a dangerous job. Rather, what they're suggesting, he's talking about Black Lives Matter, is that there is a specific problem that's happening in African-American communities that's not happening in other communities, and that is a legitimate issue that we've got to address. Do you agree with him, Neil?
Yeah, so I was there seated listening to him when he made that comment in front of our group, and I do agree. You see, we all realize that all lives matter or should matter. You know, after the Black Lives Matter a movement began, then you saw law enforcement coming out saying Blue Lives Matter. Now, I've got over 34 years in law enforcement. I've lost numbers of friends, one in particular, Ed Totley, you know, to this war on drugs, a great police officer and a good friend of mine.
the thing is, we know blue lives matter because look what we do for our surviving families. Look what we do, how we honor those men and women in blue for the service that they give and how they dedicate lives, you know, to this profession and keeping people safe. We do so much for that. You know, when you look at the data, it's clear that white lives matter. You know, when you look at how we enforce these laws and how we and where we enforce these laws and in what communities we enforce these laws, mainly our drug laws, it's clear that white lives matter. We know that. But it's not clear, especially to the African-American community, that their lives matter when you look at the data. There's a distinct problem here. And that movement just wants to make that clear. They're not saying that other lives don't matter. They want to bring it out in front of people to make sure that they understand that, hey, folks, look at the data. Black lives matter, folks. It, you know, the data at the rate of which, and I know they try to shift it to black-on-black crime, but that's a whole different story. Well, our men and women in blue are supposed to be guardians of our society, and we have to change our policies and how we go about enforcing laws within certain communities of color.
And that's Neil Franklin joining us along with Nicole Fortier, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Mark from Chestnut Hill in Philadelphia to join us. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Ripped the speaker out of my radio listening to somebody talk about addicts infecting themselves by choice. I have a family member, a son, who is borderline personality disorder and bipolar and an addict. Hmm. He's not an addict by choice. He's an addict because his insurance provider, he's on SSI because he's disabled, and his insurance does not cover the psychiatric care that he needs. He'll go to a crisis response center, and they will authorize maybe 5 days, maybe 30 days. I have a 36-year-old son who is mentally ill, and because of that, he turns to drugs and alcohol for self-medication.
Well, you know, Mark, I'm very glad that you called the show, and I apologize because we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye, but you raised a very important issue of mental illness. And Nicole, if I can go back to you, something like a third of prison and jail inmates, maybe even more, have some mental health issue or some substance abuse problem, and Mark is talking about his son who has both.
Absolutely. The studies I've seen suggest up to 50% of our federal and state prison populations house somebody with some degree of mental illness and a combination with drug addiction. They're very often overlapping. And he's absolutely right. It's a real shame in our society that we have more mentally ill in prison and in jail than we do in hospitals. And this is a health issue, as Neil said. This is not a criminal justice issue, and we have to stop asking our police to deal with it as such and ask them to be the only responders for those who need help.
Well, I hate to end on that note only because we have so much more to talk about. Nicole Fortier, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she's counsel in the justice program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and that's at NYU School of Law. Senior coordinator for the Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. Neil Franklin, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. And I also want to thank Nicole and the Brennan Center for that great work. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm saying you're welcome from them, and you're welcome from us as well. And Neil Franklin, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And to stay with us, we'll be right back.